Hey everyone, Clifford and I just finished recording a future episode together in person, but we decided to put the end of that with this episode, so stay tuned for that once the regular content's done.
Toka podcast with Patrick Santino
and Clifford Vickery.
Cool, how you been, dude?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Yeah, pretty good.
You excited for Thanksgiving?
No, dude. So I'm pretty sure I looked at it when we release this episode. It'll be the day after Christmas.
What?
It's supposed to be Christmas themed.
Okay, you excited for Christmas?
Well, I think Christmas just happened, but yeah, it's good.
Okay,
it's good. Yeah. How was your Christmas?
It was great.
Yeah,
right, yeah. Cool. I can't even remember what I got, but what are we talking about today, Patrick?
Oh, right. Yeah, we do that at the beginning. Okay, so today we'll talk about Mirkwood. We'll talk about a misstep on the hero's journey. We'll talk about spires.
A misstep or a missed step?
Missed step.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah, we'll talk about spires, and we'll talk about the step we do hit on the hero's journey today. Yeah, we started to meet some elves in this chapter. We're actually just going to save all of that discussion for the next episode, where we kind of just think it would fit better.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we get into it with
Cliff's notes. All right. So chapter 8 of The Hobbit, Flies and Spiders. The company begins their march into Mirkwood without Gandalf. Spirits are low. The forest is dark. They heed the advice to hold to the trail, but they began running low on supplies. Eventually, a swift, enchanted river blocks their path. With some cleverness, they manage to make it across, but not without Bomber, the fattest of the dwarves, falling in. Bomber is left in a stupor, and the rest of the group has to carry him on their backs. Although they actually have gotten pretty close to the end of the forest, they don't know if they're even close, and when they run out of food, they get pretty desperate. Dwarves get lured off the path by firelight and singing in the woods, and while the light continues to evade them, they lose their bearings and each other and are captured by giant spiders. Bilbo manages to escape and kill his capturer and rather suddenly becomes a heroic warrior, almost single-handedly fighting off the spider clan, fooling them, and freeing the dwarves. They make a break for it with Bilbo in command, essentially, and they eventually escape, only to find that Thorin is missing. In the chaos and darkness, Thorin was captured by woodland elves, whose king is none too fond of dwarves, and Thorin, is locked up in the elven dungeon.
All right. Yeah. Yep, that about covered it. This was a long chapter.
It was. This was, seemed like the most intense action that we've had so far.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I thought the lead up, like walking, until they started seeing like the elf fires, it was a fairly slow chapter.
Correct.
But then, yeah.
Correct.
Then it really heated up.
Uh-huh.
But
I agree.
Yeah, I thought this was actually the most entertaining part so far when he was fighting off the spiders.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
It felt like one thing and then another.
Yeah. I think I enjoyed it more than the Gollum scenes.
Yeah, this seemed to me like almost every chapter so far has been very singular. Like one thing happens and that's the chapter.
Yeah.
And this felt like the first chapter where there were multiple things all at once.
Yeah, I feel like there was like three things. There was like the forest, the elves, and there was the spiders.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it was a lot though. All right, do you have any questions like off the bat?
I definitely do. You know I do.
Yeah. Are we going to do any today?
So, I was curious. This felt like another place, kind of like the beginning of the story and some of the other phases where I get the impression that a lot of time has passed by while they're hiking and walking, but it was hard to glean from references in the book. So do we have a sense of the timeline here? Because this might give us a sense of how tired and desperate the group was.
Let's see. So I'm thinking it's like a month, but I didn't check the Atlas of Middle Earth. That would know. But I'm saying this took like a month to get through this woods, this forest.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the map, it seriously takes up like most of the map.
What amazed me, or what threw me for a loop, was I know they're told not to drink any water in the forest. And then when they cross the river, they know they can't drink it because it's enchanted. But somehow they managed to make it this far with water.
Well, Bjorn told them, packed them water.
I know, but that's so much water. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to tell you, dude.
Okay. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't know. Did you have a question about the river?
I did. Basically, what's the story behind it? What I got from the chapter is that Bomber fell asleep when he fell in, and he started dreaming of woodland feasts, which are similar to what the group witnesses later on when they venture off the path. What's the story behind it?
Yeah, I don't really actually know the story on this one. It's just, I mean, the river's called the Enchanted River, so maybe this is a most special river as opposed to any others. But okay. I also was wondering, you know, he dreamed of the elf feast that they actually end up seeing eventually. So mm-hmm. I figure the river's connected with the elf's power of the area.
Interesting.
Yeah, maybe it's something that has the good elf magic that they were referring to when Bilbo, after he saved all the dwarves, they made it back to one of the rings of like the fire pit rings that the elves were feasting at the night before.
Right.
And they said there was some sort of good magic around that, so the spiders just didn't enter there. I feel like that whatever magical presence was there is probably in the river too, would be my guess. Okay,
so it's tied to the presence of elves in the forest.
Yeah.
Which we didn't know about. We didn't know anything about that going in, right?
No.
The only advice that Bjorn and Gandalf gave them is don't drink the water. The forest is enchanted. It can be dangerous.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, so we heard about all the foreshadowing that Mirkwood's gonna be hard and dangerous, and we even like talked about like real Mirkwoods like on the cusp of entering them in the last chapter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so what did we think of it now that we were finally in it?
It sounded extremely gloomy and intense. I think we mentioned some of these last time. What we thought might be real life examples of. Something like Mirkwood, like a true old growth forest. Like I was saying, I think it's called something like the Białowieża forest in Poland, which apparently is like a snippet of what ancient Europe looked like. Like it's a last kind of prehistoric window into that time. That's something that came to mind, is like massive old oak trees, kind of strange, mysterious things. Gnarled. It's like the first word that I think of.
Yeah.
But that said, it doesn't sound like a beautiful place. Like it sounds like there's a faint aura of death to it with the darkness.
Which doesn't sound like a beautiful place? The Poland?
Mirkwood.
One,
Mirkwood. Yeah, Mirkwood. Okay. My impression with like these old forests that we're comparing it to are probably pretty beautiful because they're lush in a very particular way.
Yeah. Well, so I was looking up pictures trying to figure out if we could actually find like a forest that would probably look like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the Bio, how do you say that?
Białowieża?
The Białowieża forest in Poland. And then I think you had once mentioned this too, Olympic National Park in Washington.
Okay, yeah.
Like those pictures started to kind of get close to it, but I think they were too picturesque and pretty for all the pictures I was seeing. Now that's probably intentional on the photographer's part to like, make it attractive looking. So I guess like if you want to look up pictures of that, then you start to get a feel of what it's like. But then you got to go and make it much creepier and darker. Because here's just some of the adjectives or some of the phrases I was picking out about Mirkwood as I was reading this thing. Uh-huh. Light from above can't get through. Old and strangled with ivy and hung with lichen, blackened leaves. All cave dwellers even felt suffocated. Pitch dark nights, eyes staring at you. Not even watch fires were useful. Squirrels don't even taste good. Can't drink the water. And it's so dark that they couldn't even see the boat on the other side of the river. Mm-hmm. Also, I just a side note, I just thought it was weird that hobbits somehow have better eyesight than dwarves. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, that sounded like a recent addition to me. I don't remember that from the beginning.
Well, I had almost thought, you know, if before I read that, I would have just guessed maybe goblins see better in the dark, but after that, dwarves would be the best.
In the dark?
Yeah. Well, this whole place is dark. So
I know, but it wasn't the issue with the river kind of a long-distance vision thing?
No, they were saying like 30 yards or something. Okay. How is that long distance?
No, it's not. That's not very long.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's. I just didn't. I mean, it must have been dark if they could barely see that far.
Yeah,
you know?
No kidding. So, do we know if Tolkien has a particular inspiration for Mirkwood and these forests? Is this kind of just a fantasy image of what the dark and gnarly forest of old looks like?
Yeah.
Like is it a place he's been or is thinking of?
No, I think it's just more just what we talked about in the last chapter, just the old, whatever the big forest was that divided the eastern, like, prairie steppes that we think would probably be Russia. Whatever that old forest in Germany, ancient Germany was.
Mm-hmm.
That was never something that was actually described. It was just something that was known to be dangerous, and you probably had to go through it, but it was just something in the way. There was nothing particular about it as a destination. Okay. So I think he's just filling in the gaps here.
Ooh, that made me think. Look up some pictures of Black Forest. I feel like this might be the gnarliness you're after.
All right, Black Forest.
And just do that and go to images. There's some spooky looking stuff.
That's spookier. See, I feel like none of these are like dense enough, though.
I know. They're not actually as dark as we want them to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've got the gnarliness.
Yeah.
You see the one with like a portal of oak trees?
Yeah.
Anyways, Black Forest is my vote for what it looks like most. I was going to toss in here two bits. We know that Tolkien is pulling from Norse and Nordic mythology quite a bit throughout these stories. Like, I'd say in terms of like parts of the world where he's referencing, it's the Nordic and Anglo-Saxon tales and history, I think, that are like the primary references. And the forest plays a pretty prominent role in a lot of Nordic stories. Like, the Nordic countries are covered almost entirely in forests. The forests are part of how they see the world. Like, the Norse worldview is built around a tree. And I might be going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but to pull in a little bit of an architectural reference, there's a great book called Genius Loci by a guy named Christian Norberg Scholes. He's a Norwegian architecture critic that is all about the spirit of place and how that impacts like different cultures and their mindsets on things. And his take is that somewhere like Northern Europe, where you have these intense forests, that becomes part of the psyche in a way. And that like the kind of dark, gnarly complexity of the forest motivates how they build their societies and how their architecture functions and how they live their lives. Whereas in contrast, for example, like the kind of radical monumentality of Egypt and the intensity of the sun and the flooding of the Nile and the desert motivates a different sort of worldview and a different sort of architecture and intention and society. So, an interesting reference. And I think you can see some parallels in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
I mean, I think in general, just for lots of mythologies, like the forest is, I mean, anything that's like unknown like that, but specifically a dark forest of uncharted, like basically territory. Yeah, I think that fits into like the northern part, and like that is more attractive to Tolkien than the big monuments of standard kind of ordered monuments of like ancient Egypt. He liked the north more than the Mediterranean.
For what it's worth, in Genius Loci, in that book, his references, he places Greece, ancient Greece and Rome, as like the halfway point between the kind of complex and dark landscape of the north and the bright, abstract, pure landscape of northern Africa and the Middle East. Greece has enough complexity and rolling hills and variety that you lack the sort of same purity, but it's also a lot more austere and open than the Nordic forest. So anyways, enough about that.
All right. Well, we'll come back to that. Lots of jumping off points there.
Going off the forest, or perhaps speaking of staying on the path, can we reason at all why this path through Mirkwood is safe and why the forest is so dangerous? Like, we know we've gotten advice from Bjorn and Gandalf previously to stay on the path at all costs. And from what we can tell, the dwarves and Bilbo do so, and they're fine. And as soon as they venture off the path, things go haywire.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were ever saying the path is safe. I think they were saying more it's the most safe way to get through, or at least dangerous part of the forest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is, if you want to have any chance of succeeding to get out of this, you have to stay on the one clear track that's there.
Fair. So you think it's primarily, like, a navigational thing and a speed, like, if you're not on the path, you go slower, you run into more obstacles, therefore you're more likely to find trouble.
Well, and they were saying this whole place is enchanted, and we saw that too. I mean, there's probably, I don't know if there's magic protecting the path, but off the path there's clearly magic, like probably bad magic and or the good magic that they're talking about with the elves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I kind of felt to me though, like, they keep mentioning they see eyes in the forest at night constantly all over the place, but nothing comes of it. Like, it's like they're being watched, but they're untouched while they stay on the path, and then as soon as they go off the path, almost right away they get captured. It felt to me like it was like a kind of snap of a finger, you broke your spell.
Well, maybe that was the good luck stuff again, but then again, you were thinking that this chapter reflected their when bad luck comes up for them.
Yeah, so to expand on that a little bit, we've talked a whole bunch of times about luck and chance. For example, Bilbo finding the ring at just the right instant, Bilbo putting on the ring at the right instant and without knowing what it does, that type of thing, which from afar seems like it's just lucky and maybe detracts from the power of the story. But something I thought that might be worth discussing with this chapter is the opposite, where it seems like you've got persistent bad luck that's like, oh, come on, you know, like Bilbo climbs up a tree to see where they are, and even though they're near the edge of the forest, because they're in a valley, it looks like he's seeing trees in every direction. So he assumes that they've got forever to go. Bomber is a total fool and falls in the water, and then he blatantly ignores the advice that they had strictly adhered to the whole time and almost gets everyone killed. And then,
well, I think they all wanted to jump off the trail when they saw the fire. That wasn't just Bomber.
Fair, but it seemed like, well, okay, I'll keep going. And then Thorin, who's theoretically the leader of the expedition, gets captured, and no one has any idea where he is, which is, like, terrible, terrible luck. All these things feel like just, like, the worst possible scenario. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. If you think this is, like, they're getting punished somehow, is it fate? Is it just bad luck? Am I making a big deal out of it?
Well, no, I think I disagree with you. I think throughout the book we've seen that Bilbo's lucky, and by extension, when he's lucky, the whole group has been pretty lucky. But in general, the dwarves probably are not lucky.
Okay.
They kind of show that here. Like, the climbing the tree in the valley, I mean, I think that's just incompetence on the whole group's part, that it's like, what, you guys didn't recognize you were in a valley? I mean, I don't actually even blame Bilbo on that whatsoever, because he's the least traveled of them. I mean, I think I'd make that mistake if I was walking through a big forest like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you're Thorin, who's probably 200 something years old, who's walked all the time, I mean, yeah, what are you doing, buddy? Like, you should know, you should be able to tell, I don't know, you should be able to tell about, like, land rises and stuff, and be able to tell if you're actually at the bottom of a valley. So so I blame the dwarves on that one.
Fair.
Bomber was just annoying me the whole chapter, and I mean, it was deliberately foreshadowed that something bad was going to happen to him, and then it did.
So, do you think that Tolkien kind of deliberately made him sort of a buffoon for this?
I don't know. I mean, it starts to, we already knew he's the fat one, but now he's like kind of got a separate character than the rest, I guess.
He's just dangerous himself.
Yeah, so now, like, at this point, we know who Bomber is. We know who, well, we've always known who Thorin is. We know who Bomber is. I'd say we kind of know who Balin is. And Keely and Feely are the young ones. And then the only other one we know is Oin and Gloin are the ones who are good at fire building.
Yeah, but those are pretty minimal details, right?
Yeah, so now, I don't know. It kind of, like, helped us what's a different word than accentuate?
Establish or create.
He established another one of these dwarves, kind of come into his, like, let him come into his own.
Okay, interesting.
I don't know. And Thorin getting captured, he was a leader, and, you know, the third time he walked out himself to try to meet the elves, so I think that's, like, actually a good show on his part, but he got captured, and what are you going to do on that one, is what I'd kind of just say.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd also like to say is, look at all the examples of the good luck that was actually in this chapter again. That was kind of some not written, some he still exactly mentioned, literally mentions the word luck again. So they were saying that the first half of the forest was the darker and more like wilder side of the forest. And so they actually got through that clean. Like, they didn't have any problems until they got to the Enchanted River, which is it's more that it's past the halfway mark. And then when Bilbo is put to sleep.
Yeah. Quick note. Sorry. I'll get back to that in a second. Keep going.
Yeah, well, Bilbo's put to sleep by the elf fires the second time that they sneak up on him, and Dory trips over him, and the book states, by pure luck, he trips over him. So again, Bilbo's good luck, they're finding him. When the dwarves start shouting out of fear by the goblins, by pure luck, Bilbo guesses the right direction they were going in. It was lucky he came to his senses in time while the first spider was wrapping him in, like, his web, basically. And then, I mean, just in general, yeah, Bilbo showed his competence when he was fighting the spiders here, but, I mean, yeah, that's still, luck's still with him. Good luck is still with him on that part.
You're reinforcing your theory that luck is almost like a tangible quality, or like something that you might possess and pass on or kind of carry with you. Like, Bilbo is a lucky individual in that he possesses, like, this force of luck.
Yeah, the narrator also noted here Bilbo was, like, born with some of it, too. So it's like, all right, we can kind of work off that as well. Yeah, so it's something he just has always had. But yeah, had. Okay. It's like a possession, I'd say.
Or at the very least, if not a possession, like a backing force. It's like Athena in the Odyssey.
Yeah, okay. I think so. I don't know, that kind of leads into this hero's journey step that Bilbo doesn't really get to.
Okay. Hey.
Okay. All right, so this is the step meeting with the goddess. So again, Bilbo doesn't really hit this. I'll make, like, an extreme reach of a claim that maybe he does here, but whatever. So, meeting with the goddess is at the zenith of the world, or at the edge of the world, or within the deepest chamber of the heart. The goddess and hero either bond or form a union of love of some sort, or in a previous step, the goddess, or as in previous steps, the goddess helps the hero in some way, gives objects and weapons, maybe gives him some sort of support. Star Wars, this is when Luke meets Leia.
Okay.
In that first movie, in episode 4, that was basically a romantic relationship. Throughout the trilogy, they figure out, oh, shoot, we're twins. So it becomes a familial bond, but that was definitely the thing there. In the Odyssey, when Odysseus finally gets home, which is only halfway through the book, the first person, he's not actually sure he's home yet, but the first person he meets is Athena, who's been protecting him the entire way.
Right.
This step is clearly happens in Lord of the Rings.
Okay. So we'll get back to this in the future.
Yeah, we can't talk about it here.
Okay.
All right, so for this book, though, if we want to make an extreme reach, we could kind of treat luck as a goddess, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, I think you're pushing it, but keep going.
Like some sort of, like, you know, pagan goddess or something. Like, yeah, I mean, because like lots of the deities are, what's the word? personified, like, or lots of just, I don't know, qualities. What's luck?
Like, I think like a quality or a force almost.
Yeah, like, lots of qualities or forces or whatever are kind of personified as a god. Like in the Bible, wisdom mm-hmm. is.
Okay. And that's pretty common in Greek mythology, Norse mythology.
Yeah, so if we want to say that, maybe this is the closest time, or this is the time that Bilbo's like the luckiest of the entire book, maybe. Uh-huh. Which would kind of explain how he handled himself so well throughout this whole chapter. And I think that all kind of culminates when he names his sword Sting. Like, there's the passage here. Somehow the killing of a giant spider all alone by himself in the dark without the help of the wizard or the dwarves or of anyone else made a great difference to Mr. Baggins. He felt a different person and much fiercer and bolder in spite of an empty stomach. This is where he names the sword Sting. So, like, they had made references, like, maybe get, like, an object or something out of it. Like, this is where he already had the sword, but now he's, like, named it. And now he feels like he's a different person.
Okay.
Of all the moments in this book, this would be probably the singular most where you could say Bilbo comes of age.
Yeah, I certainly noticed that. That felt very present.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the whole thing of Gandalf leaving is kind of like a rite of passage for Bilbo to, like, finally step up and be more.
Right, be thrown into a situation where he's not taking orders from Gandalf. I was going to pitch in here. Some of you might be saying, why are we talking about a step on the hero's journey that Bilbo doesn't meet? I think part of the reason it's significant is that The Hobbit comes so close to hitting almost every step on the hero's journey, which is kind of uncommon with most of these stories, even ones where we're using for a bunch of examples, that it's worth noting places where the narrative has changed slightly, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to just cover them all.
Okay, that's fair. Here, so okay.
In case anybody's just, like, you know, keeping score of where we're at.
Okay.
We checked that box off too, that we covered that one.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of this heroism and Bilbo going through a sort of transformation, this was another place where we had capturers, like trolls or goblins, in this case the spiders, making much ado about nothing before doing the actual killing, which gives everyone time to escape, which works out wonderfully for us. Feels like kind of a classic children's story dilemma. This time, however, Bilbo seems transformed. What do we make of it? How many spiders does he kill? It seems like he launches himself into being like a true warrior.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't actually think about that too much because I was just kind of actually entertained the whole time reading it.
Mm-hmm.
About Bilbo. Like for the first half of this chapter, I was taking so many notes, partly just because I was like slightly more bored reading through it.
Okay. Whereas while they're hiking, you mean?
Yeah. While he's fighting the spiders, I was just like, good job, Bilbo. Wow, that's impressive, Bilbo.
that's all I was noting. To me, it felt like this felt like a battle and not just an escape. Like a lot of the other action scenes before have been like, ooh, how did we get away? This was like a lot more brutal.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was like, well, the dwarves were all basically incapacitated. And I mean, they were kind of doing their best in that situation. Mm-hmm. I can't really imagine what spider poison would feel like. But yeah, I imagine it would feel terrible. And trying to run away with that is tough. And so, yeah, Bilbo's basically a one-man show to actually fight the spiders.
Yeah. It just felt like a kind of amazing transition.
Well, I mean, I think like success breeds success, maybe.
Okay.
Like he was invisible, which is helpful, obviously. and then he's kind of just thriving off his own luck.
Does the elvish dagger that he uses as a sword, does this play into it at all? It definitely feels like it's a lucky weapon, but does it have any force against the spiders or no?
Yeah, the sword's Gondolin do. I was going to cover that in Lord of the Rings, but...
They work against spiders.
Gondolin was located near where a bunch of evil spiders would have lived, much like these ones.
Okay.
So their swords were... When they crafted their swords, they could, I don't know, they had the spiders in mind as one of the things that they would be fighting with them.
Okay, and just as a refresher for me, I remember that Thorin's sword and Gandalf's sword that they took from the trolls are from Gondolin. Yeah. And Bilbo just grabs a dagger
because he's small. It's also from Gondolin.
Okay, that's what I thought. So because
it turns blue.
It's too small to have a name. It's still a good sword.
Yeah. Okay. I actually like to imagine it was like a kid's sword, but
okay,
that's just a theory of mine.
Okay.
Maybe I'll cool. talk about it. I'll talk about it at some other point, too. All right. Should we actually talk about the spiders?
Yeah. So who are they? Just more giant evil beasts that we've run across before?
Yeah. So we had the wargs before and the big eagles.
Yeah.
Anything else yet so far?
The trolls
kind of?
Trolls, stone giants are not really animals, but...
Yeah, but they weren't really involved.
Okay.
They were, yeah. Well, yeah, so this one, there's no historical references for it or mythology references. This was kind of just Tolkien's own pure creation, which I guess you could say, oh, a big spider, how clever is that? Especially now, since you see all sorts of giant creatures and fantasy all the time. But I don't know. It might have been original. It was probably original when he first wrote this, I think, in the 30s.
Say it again. It was probably what?
It was probably original when he, like, an original idea to have, like, a giant spider when he first wrote these. I mean, you know, Harry Potter
completely. I mean, you have to, of course, talk about eight-legged freaks. I'm just joking.
I don't know what that is.
You don't know eight-legged freaks?
No.
One of the best, like, C-list horror movies that I watched as a 10-year-old. you should Google search a picture for yourself now or in the future.
Okay. All right.
There's a sequel as well.
Okay, I'm gonna keep going, man.
This movie's so bad. Okay.
All right. So
back on the path.
Yeah. Well. So, anyways, though, in his own life, there was a funny story. When so remember where was Tolkien born? It was a quiz, Clifford.
In South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was out in South Africa, and he had like, I think they had like probably some. Like a good size yard and everything, like if not acres to themselves. Okay. I don't really know, but because they had a big house and they definitely had a lawn and yard and a garden and everything. But yeah, one time Tolkien was running around as like probably 2 or 3 year old, and he accidentally stepped on a tarantula and it bit him, and his nurse had to like run up to him and suck out the poison. He claims this is not what made him hate spiders or dislike them at all, even, because he also said in one of his letters, I think I don't have it where it was, but he said once, because fans were asking him, like, what's your beef with spiders in all his writing, because of this chapter, and he said, well, you know, actually I don't mind spiders at all, like when they fall in the bathtub I'll even pull the spider out of the water before it drowns and save it. But I think I also read that one of his sons, and I think it was Michael, was scared of spiders, so he put this part in for him while he was like maybe not quite a teenager when he was writing this, just to kind of scare him a little bit, or I don't know, make it entertaining again.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the only thing I think where we're working off these spiders, but this is a pretty iconic section of it. There's some iconic stuff in the next series.
What do you think of the chapter title, Flies and Spiders? I took it to mean there's a brief reference where they say that the dwarves are tied up kind of like flies are before spiders eat them. And it implies that the company is like a band of flies. Any bigger significance there?
No, I don't think so. I think that's all I got to.
Do you like the characterization?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
I think flies are kind of gross. It's my only hesitation.
What, and the dwarves aren't gross?
It just seems like a pretty unworthy creature to compare yourself to.
Well, you're trapped in a spider's net. I think that's...
Yeah, fair. Okay. Well, so speaking of being trapped in spiders' nests, I've got some more questions for you about spiders.
Mm-hmm.
Bilbo was taunting them, singing some songs at them, and the narrator throws in some little bits like, oh, and the spiders got so mad because they hate to be called Addercop. There are some insults like Addercop, Lazy Lob, Tom Noddy. What do these mean? Where do they come from?
Looks like Addercop was the old English word for spider, and it's also kind of close to the current Norwegian word for spider.
Okay.
But ator means poison in old English, and they think cop means probably meant head in old English, so poison head.
Okay.
So that's what and lob is another word for spider. And then the Tom Noddy just means like kind of like stupid fool or something. That's what okay. I was looking up. Not sure why Addercop would actually enrage them. I thought that was kind of weird. Maybe that's like, what's the word? What's the word for
slur?
Yeah, maybe it's a racial slur for spiders. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, that's what I got on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then after they manage to escape the spiders, Bilbo reveals the secret of his ring and how he was invisible the whole time and part of how he evaded the spiders. And he tells the full story of getting the ring to the dwarves, which comes off as being pretty lighthearted, but Balin was particularly interested. Does this create any new conflicts? Like, do we take anything away from... Is there anything underfoot because Bilbo mentions the ring? Jealousy, etc.?
I don't think so, especially since there was a line, knowing the truth about the vanishing did not lessen their opinion of Bilbo at all. Before they saw that he had some wits as well as luck and a magic ring, and all three were very useful possessions. So, okay.
So it's as though a magic ring is just, oh, it's a magic ring. It's just a thing.
Yeah, and it's not attributing all of Bilbo's success only to having the ring. They were saying okay. wits and his luck, and yeah, he's not just tied. All his success doesn't just hinge on that.
Okay. I know they made a point of Balin being particularly interested and confused, but I thought this could be just be Tolkien poking fun at him because he was the one who was on guard the last time Bilbo snuck past them.
Yeah, as far as I know, I think that's what it is too. Or based on okay. what we've read so far, that's my only guess as well. On mm-hmm. that. Yeah, but finally though, like the dwarves were basically bowing down to him too, and like they were literally bowing to him after this one. Like they were so like thankful to Bilbo. Like
yeah.
none of this was only just because he could turn invisible and he had a ring. I mean, there was more. Even not just that, Bilbo had to clearly step up another level to do all this.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, it wasn't just taking initiative. It wasn't just being generous. It wasn't just being a good fighter. It was like he kind of threw everything together. He was clever and quick on his feet and like pretty victorious in fighting the spiders and courageous. It was very impressive.
It kind of leads us into our next step on Hero's Journey.
One that we did actually cross. I can be your hero, baby. There
goes my hero. Watch him as he goes. I'm a hero. He's larger than life. Larger than life. Alright, so this step is the Road of Trials. So, the okay. hero is covertly aided by the advice, amulets, and secret agents of the supernatural leader whom he met before his entrance into the region. Or okay. it may be that he discovers for the first time that there is a benign power everywhere supporting him in his superhuman passage.
Interesting.
Should we do examples?
I would love to do some examples. I just want to ask real quick if this benign power supporting him actually fits hand in hand with the case you were making earlier for luck being sort of a goddess.
Yeah,
if I think it's really like luck is like this benign power, like what we've been calling luck is a benign power that Bilbo has been using to his advantage.
Yeah, I think Bilbo nails both of these right on.
Okay,
which all right. It's for like, and I mean those sentences I just pulled straight from the first paragraph of the chapter, like word for word. So okay. I mean, like, I didn't even like try to angle this to fit Bilbo. Like this yeah. one, he just nails them. Yeah.
That's good. Okay, let's do right, some yeah, let's some do other examples, and then we'll tie it back to the Hobbit.
Okay, so for me, I think for the Star Wars example, I think this is basically every scene once Obi-Wan says goodbye to Luke. So. Uh-huh. That means when Luke and Han are in the prison to get Princess Leia and they're doing all the fight there, mm-hmm. then when they're in the trash compactor, not that they actually did much of value there. But I mean, that was a fight scene, or I don't know. That was an action scene, I guess.
Yeah, but it's then, like tribulations.
Yeah, and then escaping the Death Star, whether that's like running all over the place and then flying the ship out, and then they had to like kill the ships that were following them. And then I think it even includes the climax of the movie where Luke gets into the huge space battle where he destroys the Death Star. I think that's just part of the stuff. I'm not really sure. That, and, you know, those kind of, like, they... I wouldn't say arc. I don't know. Like, they... Each fight gets bigger and bigger, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I was thinking of, the labors of Hercules. He had to do a bunch of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
You got any examples top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I might be pushing it here or switching some stuff up, but Finding Nemo, which I know I've mentioned before, I think is a pretty classic example where you've got like one thing and another challenge. Like definitely some of the earlier challenges, like the sharks, I think we mentioned as an earlier step in the hero's journey. Like that's kind of the first, crossing the first threshold, like it's the first encounter with danger. But I can think of later on, like when they go into the deep sea and escape the angler, when they go through the swarm of jellyfish, and when they get captured by the whale, all of those, to my mind, are trials along the road, even though they might overlap or kind of coexist with other steps along the journey.
Yeah, I think in general, this is just like probably the easiest step to identify, period, in any sort of...
I have to imagine it's kind of like filler in a heroic story.
It's like the Odyssey
is like the Odyssey part of the Odyssey is the road of trials, right?
One that's just coming to my mind randomly is like Saving Private Ryan. Like there's after the in between D-Day and the final fight scene, that whole thing's just road of trials, like where two of the guys are getting killed, but there's just about like three battles along the way in between those. I mean,
right?
Yeah, that, like that's it, it is.
This
kind
is
of
just like
it's
filler. Not necessarily filler, but like plot. It's just like this is not necessarily a climax or transformation. This is like walking down the path.
But yeah, and it's particularly applicable here to Bilbo as they go on a forest road. You already mentioned the whole luck thing, but you know this is when the supernatural leader basically gets out of the way, so Gandalf's left, now they're on their own, now it's really time to step up.
Okay.
And Bilbo, you know, he's useful. We started to finally have respect for Bilbo, I'd say, in the fifth chapter with Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, because he had to be on his own and survive himself.
Right.
But then in the sixth chapter, he was kind of just going along, but we kind of gave him a pass again, but he was just kind of not quite baggage again, but he was just one of the guys in the party following Gandalf's direction. And then
dragging his feet, wishing he was home.
Yeah, and with Beorn that was just a rest chapter, so it's not like much is going on anyways. Yeah.
Right.
But here he seems useful right away. Like he's involved with the whole getting across the river. Mm-hmm. He climbs the trees to see everything, and then as we've already talked about, I mean, he nailed it and killed it with the spiders. Like, that was sweet.
Yeah,
he did a good job. Like, I'm a wholehearted Bilbo fan at this point with that one.
Yeah, he feels way more like a classic heroic main character than he has in the past.
Yeah, and now it's to the point where we're slightly questioning. It's like, well, Thorin's the official leader, but is Bilbo the real leader here?
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of like on our Lake Michigan trip, our bike trip. For everybody that doesn't know, we did Clifford and I and my cousin Mike, we all are friends from high school. We did a bike trip around Lake Michigan with, like, no training whatsoever, so, like, it was, like, hell to hop into. But you could probably say...
1,000 miles, 11 days.
Yeah, so you could probably say I was the official leader of the trip. But, you know, when it came down to it, Clifford just did everything. Finally, like, Clifford cooked, like, every meal, had all the directions. Like, the only
Patrick
thing
is our spiritual leader.
Yeah. Yeah, I documented it. I was the filmer. So, somebody could be the leader in name, basically, but Bilbo seems to be taking on the actual hard job leadership. I'd say. But, and then I think it's also important to remember that, you know, this was kind of just maybe like 1.5 episodes of like the Road to Trials. I think it's going to keep going in the next couple chapters here as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry if that's a slight spoiler, but I mean.
No, we have to, I have to imagine that there's more on the journey until they hit the final climax.
Yep. They're definitely, well, I mean, Thorin's captured, you know?
Yeah.
Let's not go overboard, but like let's just spend like a couple minutes talking about the elves here.
Okay. So I think next time we're gonna touch more on background, because I have some questions for Patrick about who these elves are specifically, where they're from, etc. But we'll get to that in the future. Some of the specifics for right now. When the dwarves are going off into the forest because they saw firelight and they heard the sounds of feasting and singing, I think we got the impression that these are elves that they're chasing after. But the elves kind of just disappear as soon as anyone shows up or there's a single noise. Is this magic? Are they really seeing elves? Is there some sort of like teleportation thing going on?
Well, what? Yes. So we've already met elves in this book.
Right.
But these ones didn't really seem like the ones in Rivendell. Mm-hmm. To me, at least.
They seem distinctly more mischievous.
I don't even know about mischievous as opposed to just shady, really.
Yeah.
Is my idea.
Yeah, more like fairies and less like jolly valley people. I don't know. Like, on the way down to Elrond's house, everyone was kind of singing and inviting them for food.
Well, the ones at Elrond's house made me think of, like, Tinkerbell fairy.
Okay. But yeah, but like very, very happy.
Yeah.
But also very wise.
Yeah.
And these ones feel like a darker, more mysterious.
Yeah, I think just in general with the last episode, we didn't go enough into, like, by the time Tolkien's writing this in the 1930s, what was the historical literature on elves based off mythology and like all of English lit, like what was their concept of it before Tolkien? Because it kind of changed almost, you know, like Tolkien kind of defined like a new elf for fantasy.
Yeah. Because we can expand upon this. I remember talking a little bit about it when we first were introduced to elves. Elves have like kind of some reference throughout Nordic and Anglo-Saxon and German mythology, but there's quite a bit of variety. And there's definitely like a mischievous element to them.
Yeah, but we're gonna tease you. We're gonna leave it there because I don't know. Well, yeah, we'll hit it in the next episode because it's kind of a long conversation, and we just think it'll fit better once we have a better picture and the elves are actually characters in the story next week.
Okay, all right. Cool. I will be patient. I'll hold my tongue. Sweet.
All right. So, Clifford, how was your Christmas?
It was pretty wonderful. Yeah. I was in Mexico, had some wonderful warm weather.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
And now I'm in Chicago.
Nice.
It was good. How was yours?
It was fun. Yeah, we had the usual thing. We had to host both sides of the family, Christmas Eve and then Christmas Day.
Cool.
But yeah, it was a good time. Yeah, what brought us together here today, besides that we wanted to see each other anyways?
At the high school cross-country reunion party. It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, it should be good. You know what, Clifford?
And just in the nick of time.
Oh, who's here?
Jimmy and the Connollys and Jack Doyle.
Nice.
So,
oh, yeah.
Cool.
I want to talk to you guys.
Yeah, we'll be up in like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Oh, Jimmy's gonna love that I do a Lord of the Rings podcast.
I know, they're kidding. All right.
So, yeah, I just thought it'd be fun to do a couple of these questions here. Just not those ones.
Are you giving people a sample of the trivia questions?
Yeah. Okay. For tonight, I just thought it'd be fun to make like a little trivia game for. All the guys coming back. So, the Ignatius Cross Country team ran downtown Chicago figuratively and literally. And yeah, so we're a pretty goofy team. But and some of these questions, I thought these kind of reflected it. These are not ones we're using, so these won't be a spoiler.
Okay.
It's a pet peeve of mine to actually do trivia on podcasts. I hate it when other people do it.
But you're just fulfilling the prophecy?
It's a lose-lose for the people doing it. Because if the guy doesn't get it, then it's like, well, you don't look qualified. and then if they do get it, then it's like, woo, big deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But since this is just not related, I thought it was funny. All right, okay. Here's another one. Okay. When the Ignatius team was messing around downtown and people told us to stop, who did we say we represented?
Whitney Young.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which neighborhood or suburb is the best at Frisbee?
Loaded question.
This is extremely loaded. Remember where you're at. Who would
probably
have written this?
Probably Beverly.
Oh, yeah. Beverly kids can throw a Frisbee for a mile. Okay. What was the crappiest city run route?
Babble Loops?
No, that was a workout. Okay. I kind of like those. Excuse
yeah, me, I thought those were cool.
Yeah, I thought those were cool,
people
too.
Bitched about them, though. I don't know.
Obviously. Well, actually, there's two acceptable answers. United Center sucked.
Oh, yeah.
Or running to Kowiski sucked.
Oh.
Yeah. Those were bad. All right. And let's see. What was on St. Ignatius of Loyola's family crest? Do not miss this one.
A wolf?
Yeah, two wolves.
Okay.
And then there's a cauldron or something, too.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. One last funny one. This is this one's actually gonna be on there, so don't spoil this. So, which fictional character did Coach Ernst claim to be a lesbian in his American Studies classes?
I can't remember. I remember you guys joking about this.
I wasn't in the class either. Like, I almost can't believe this. Still, I'm scared to use this because you're gonna come.
Yeah.
Oh, come on!
I can't remember.
Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. Okay. All right, cool. We got to go then.
Okay.
Partied up, so.
Yeah.
Well, this is great, Clifford.
Thanks, y'all. This is episode 12 of the Talking Token Podcast. Catch us on our website, Spotify, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all those good things.
Yeah, you know, we got stuff, yeah, no reviews yet, but, yeah. That'll be a big project for a future day.
Yeah.
Or a future episode, yeah.
Certainly. All right.
Okay, say thanks y'all again.
All right. Thanks y'all.